Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is Ben Friedman, Policy Director at Defense Priorities. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you.
You've just published a paper with Defense Priorities examining one of the most frequently cited rationales for perpetuating this or that U.S. military deployment and generally for maintaining an oversized military presence abroad. Whenever there's some kind of debate about it, advocates warn that if we withdraw, it'll leave a strategic and economic vacuum for other states, particularly our great power rivals, to move in and fill and obtain some kind of meaningful security gains. Before we get to that thesis, though, I want to flesh out some of the presumptions behind your arguments. So first, it's evident in this paper, but also much of your other work, that you believe that the circumstances of the modern world have altered international politics in some important ways, that the calculations that the empires of old made in pursuit of wealth and security don't apply for various reasons. And we'll come back to this concept, but you cite Carl Kaysen, for example, on why conquest doesn't pay like it used to. Why do you think that?
John Mueller wrote this book about the obsolescence of war, and Carl Kaysen wrote a review essay about it in International Security, where he sort of said he agreed with Mueller about the modern war, interstate war, at least becoming going extinct, becoming far less common. But he disagreed with Mueller about the cause. And Kaysen thought that the at least the big cause was that conquest doesn't pay like it used to, and or at least the circumstances where it paid had become fewer. And it, so the basic reason is that wealth used to be hundreds of years ago more industrial, and you had more, it was easier at least to convert conquest into greater wealth and power, because if you took over a lot of production facilities in the parts of the world that had experienced the Industrial Revolution, which for a long time was Europe and Asia and here in North America, then you would be able to convert that, at least in theory, into, you know, becoming a military juggernaut. You could basically, you know, administrate, tax the industry of the areas you took over, and use it to fuel your even larger military and become more threatening. So the idea was that then, in that sense, territorial gains could be cumulative, that you'd grow stronger. And for various reasons, I think that we're not totally out of that world. We still have production lines and things like that, and the possibility of cumulative growth, cumulative power accretion through conquest still exists. But it's far harder, I think, for a few reasons. One is that the wealth now is created more through knowledge, software, code. If you think about conquering Silicon Valley, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You can't really conquer the minds of the software engineers and gather the intellectual property through military might that you would need to kind of reap the wealth of all the tech companies out there. So in the world is becoming, at least the Western or wealthier parts of the world are becoming more like that. So it's harder to just conquer wealth and take it over. And I think that's an underappreciated cause of peace. And Kaysen, you know, talked about that a little bit, but he also just talked more broadly about the difficulties of conquest, the difficulties of converting the wealth that you conquer, even if it is sort of old school industrial power, into usable military capability. And there are various reasons for that. Beyond economic, even, you know, one of them is just nationalism, which makes it harder. Nationalism allows people to organize along national lines and resist conquest. Nationalism isn't new, but it's arguably sort of easier to whip up these days in response, or these days in a very broad sense, over decades, in response to another power trying to come in and run your country. You could arguably, you know, even transportation technology could help. People can just leave instead of staying there to be conquered. So, for example, if China tried to conquer Taiwan, which is certainly one of the likelier interstate war scenarios that are possible these days. The Taiwanese semiconductor facilities would be a big target, obviously, and there's a lot of concern about that. But it's also possible that, you know, the people who work there would just flee. Even if China did conquer it, they might have a hard time getting the knowledge that exists in the heads of the engineers who help make semiconductors to continue to be used in a way that's productive for China. So you can see a lot of problems coming up. So anyway, the conquest is getting harder, and there's various reasons for that. But it's a source of safety for countries around the world, certainly the United States, and it's also a reason why we don't have to worry so much about our enemies occupying territory, whether it's through vacuums we leave behind or something else.
So there's probably a lot of reasons U.S. leaders haven't really come around to the idea that, you know, having lots of foreign outposts, for example, is not as useful as it used to be. You point to the so-called endowment effect as potentially one explanation. Can you explain that a bit?
Yes. So there are a lot of reasons why I think, and I know you, John, wrote a good paper about this a while back, but there's a lot of reasons why bases are overvalued. But there's a concept from cognitive psychology called the endowment effect, which is basically that you tend to overvalue things that you already possess versus things that you don't. So, you know, there are a lot of analogies to pro sports where teams are historically overly reluctant based on lots of analysis to trade players they have for future draft picks and things like that. You know, we tend to want to hold on for sentimental value sometimes to things that we have, and to actually, you know, economic sense, value them more highly than they would be valued on the market or things we don't yet possess. So obviously, I think it's obvious that if that is real and it applies to foreign policy, then, you know, when we have a base overseas, we might tend to sort of attach value to it that we wouldn't attach to the prospect of getting a new base there. We sort of overvalue things because of the fact that we had them. And, you know, moving outside of the sort of psychological elements of that, I mean, I think there's politics that cause us over time, you know, to be told stories about things we possess, bases, about policies that we have, which are the alliances that bases often serve, that cause us, for not psychological reasons, for just sort of informational reasons, to be wrong about how valuable things are to us. And the, you know, the historical process of having a base, of having an alliance with a country that is serviced by a base, you know, you tend to get kind of overwrought arguments being made in favor of it, and the arguments against it are less boisterous and energetic because it doesn't matter as much to all of us who, you know, pay a little more taxes or take a little more risk because we have that base, as opposed to the people who have very strong feelings about the alliance or whatever it is, who tend to be the loudest part of the policy conversation.
You also point out that there can be, I mean, if we're pressed, we can come up with situations in which a rival state gaining influence or expanding into, say, a neighboring territory could provide that rival state with some ability to undermine the national security of the other. But that logic sort of ignores the overwhelming fact of U.S. security, that we have basically friends and fish bordering us. You write that, quote, U.S. security is so profound that almost any potential vacuums are immaterial. Can you elaborate on what factors constitute this profound security?
Yeah. So the way I was thinking about it was, look, there are these arguments about vacuums that we need to fear leaving Syria, Afghanistan at the time, the Middle East in general. We need to fear doing less in some sense in Africa and other parts of the developing world. And and I engage directly with those arguments and explain why they're wrong, but there's a kind of broader point underneath it, which is that they're all kind of engaged in, you know, I think the arguments about vacuums, like the president of the United States made one about the Middle East, arguments about vacuums are under-articulated. You know, they're not really good theories, like with clear causal logic. They're kind of folk theories that arguably are articulated largely by people who want things for other reasons and just view this as a nice rhetorical device. So I'm sort of filling in, you know, sometimes to shoot at theories like that, you kind of have to articulate them more broadly than the people who make them, who believe them. But arguments about vacuums, you know, sort of behind them, they have this kind of idea that territory in the places U.S. have bases is essential to our security, and that there must be some value in that dirt that is going to attach to, you know, another great power. That's the argument, if we leave, and they'll use that power to come after us. And so the broader point is that the United States, because of our geography, which leaves us not a world away, but a couple of oceans away from most of the trouble that bothers us, because of nuclear weapons, because of our military might, we don't really have to worry about those for security reasons, about those precise, about those small differences in the balance of power with, say, China or something. If we grant that China would gain, I don't think we should grant it, but if we grant that China would gain something from, you know, having a few troops in Afghanistan or operating more fulsomely in its foreign policy in Africa, or doing something more in Saudi Arabia, if we grant that they'd sort of gain some more influence there if we left, it really doesn't seem to make any difference to our safety and security in the United States, because the sources of it are, as you quoted, so profound that, you know, we don't have to worry about these little differences in the balance of power. And I should say that this essay is sort of it owes a lot to this stuff that Stephen Van Ever wrote at the end of the Cold War, which was provocatively titled in part "Why the Third World Doesn't Matter." He had an essay about how, you know, the bipolar competition between the United States and the Soviet Union didn't need to go on in the Third World. There wasn't enough there in terms of power capabilities, stuff that could be used to threaten the other, that we really needed to engage in competition. You know, so, and that really, had that, you know, advice been taken seriously in the Cold War, it would have been much less of a Cold War. You know, the Vietnam War, for example, we could have skipped the, you know, a lot of the coups in Chile and places like that. We could have just said, well, that doesn't matter. You know, this is a conflict about the big industrial regions of the world, primarily Europe. And the Cold War could have been a lot more mellow. So I think it's important now to say, look, we don't need to have whatever you think about great power competition with China. I think, John, like you, I'm a skeptic that we need to have a new Cold War with China, or even that we need to have intense great power competition with China. But even if you do think that, there's really good reasons to think it doesn't have to go on in the Middle East. It doesn't have to go on in the developing world. You know, we don't have to worry about China's up to something in Africa or Latin America, because of the profound advantages that we have in terms of our security. So that's sort of the underlying thought of the paper.
This will be a somewhat of a tangent, because I know it's a question that you've worked on for a lot of your career, but if it's so clear that the United States is profoundly secure, why haven't decision makers understood and internalized this? Why are we so fearful despite our safe position?
I think that power generates insecurity. It's ironic. So it's an irony of great power that you think it would make you more secure. It does, I think, in a absolute sense, it makes you more secure, having more power and more military capability and wealth, but it makes you think you're insecure. So it creates paranoia, essentially. So my argument is that as a result of the United States being so powerful for so long, we taught ourselves because of the need to kind of generate support for all our far-flung policies in the World War II and the Cold War. We taught ourselves an ideology that said we can only be safe in the world if we're in some sense dominating it. And we developed, for good reason, to sort of manage our foreign policy, all these big bureaucracies that are important to how we think about foreign policy and help kind of educate the American people into believing in this ideology. So it's sort of a, you know, my view of it is that you have a bunch of institutions, you can call it the military industrial complex or something like that, that are tied for rather material reasons to the continuation of these world spanning policies. And they help kind of create at least an elite in the United States that's very tied to this ideology that says, you know, we're very unsafe, at least unless we are very active. We have a very active foreign policy, and there's a lot of effort goes into teaching Americans that they're fundamentally insecure, because insecurity is tied to the, you know, the health and I guess ironically the security of the national security state.
So looking at this question of vacuums and the prospect of U.S. withdrawal here or there, you argue that the most likely beneficiaries, generally speaking, would be local actors, not distant great powers, if we were to withdraw from this, that, or the other area. Why do you think that's a safe generalization?
Yeah, so the way I look at it is, if you want to get specific about these vacuums arguments, and they're often made about places like where the United States, they're generally made, almost always made about places where the United States has some military presence. And so to
this
me,
is just about everywhere.
Yeah. Right. So then so as a result, you could also make it about, you know, the Middle East, as President Biden did this summer. He said, if we get out of the Middle East, we won't get out of the Middle East because we don't want to leave a vacuum for Russia, China, or Iran to fill. But my argument, basically, it's sort of three parts. It's one, there's in a lot of cases, it's not going to be a vacuum, at least it's not going to last very long. Two, if there is a vacuum, it doesn't matter to the United States. And three, which is sort of another part, is sort of another way of saying too, is that the foreign powers are not really interested in coming in and trying to fill a vacuum. And if they were, they'd be dumb. So in some ways, we're have the exact opposite view that we should have, that if we want to hurt China or Russia, we shouldn't prevent them from trying to rush into our stead in the Middle East. We should invite them to fill vacuums that we leave behind in the Middle East so they can suffer as we have. But anyway, the first part of that is that failed states, or most places where the United States sends troops, if not necessarily failed states, are states that have big problems. And we send troops there largely because of conditions like civil wars and a lot of domestic disorder. That's, you know, the kind of way the United States tends to use its military in the modern era. And so you look at Syria. We're there to fight ISIS primarily, but ISIS was there. It's complicated, but largely because there was a civil war that allowed them to become active. And we can tell a similar story about Iraq, where the United States has forces as a result of domestic disorder. Iraq's a little better organized, certainly these days, than Syria and a lot of other U.S. military occupations. So the argument is sort of like that if the United States leaves Syria or another place where there's a civil war, where we have forces or had a civil war, there'll be this vacuum. You know, everybody quotes Aristotle, nature abhors a vacuum. But my point is just there is a local government. And so failed states aren't, it's an overly, it overstates the problem that, you know, even in failed states, and there was a Cato paper years ago by Jen Keister about this, that in failed states, there's usually some kind of local government. And in that sense, they're not totally failed. And in Syria, even though there's, you know, still a civil war going on in a sense, the Assad regime is in a good position to benefit from the United States leaving. They're aided by Iran and Russia, but they're likely to take over, from an administrative standpoint, the territory that the United States troops occupy in eastern Syria. And in Afghanistan, we were warned that there would be a vacuum by some people that somehow China or Russia would fill, or some other powers, outside powers, if we left, if U.S. forces left. And what happened was U.S. forces left, and I think there was a vacuum, but the Taliban swiftly kind of assumed all the power in the state. You know, we could have a long argument, and we talked about this last time I was on, about how you feel about, you know, the Taliban taking over in Afghanistan. But the point is, for now, that there wasn't really a vacuum, and at least not one that lasted. And if to the extent there was, the beneficiaries were local powers, not, you know, other great powers that we have competition with. So there's a lot of things to say about occupying Syria, but the idea that our other great powers are going to take over if we leave aren't right.
Part of the thing that's tricky with this is that for people who essentially equate strategic dominance and extended military reach with security gains, like, there's a presumption that us being there, wherever there is a net positive, if not for U.S. security, then collectively somehow. But the whole equation of vacuums being filled by rivals kind of melts away when you notice that actually this kind of expansionist, interventionist military mindset doesn't improve U.S. security or the state of the world. It's not a strategic asset. So if China moves into the Middle East, it won't be that good for China, just as it hasn't been very good for us. Let me ask you, what do people who believe in this vacuum idea think Russia or China filling it in would look like? What do they think they would actually do? Do they think they would mimic the United States and set up bases and have mimic the set of relationships that we have? What do they think it will actually look like?
Well, I think that this is an area where, as I mentioned before, I think the sort of advocates of vacuum fears are don't really articulate what exactly they're afraid of. So it's a little easier in Syria, where you actually have a Russian presence, so you could say, okay, the Russians will have greater access to the parts of Syria where the United States military is through the Assad regime, and then the obvious question is, so what? I mean, you know, as I put it elsewhere, it's a civil war management opportunity for Russia. I mean, it's not, you know, it's really not a gift to Putin to say, oh, look, you're in charge of a patch of Syria that, you know, actually has very few people in it. And even, you know, the well-populated parts of Syria are probably even more difficult and costly to occupy. So, occupational duties, I don't think are profitable from a national security standpoint or an economic standpoint. And, this is not a new idea. You know, the old school realists, George Kennan, talking about containing the Soviet Union, said that their attempts to sort of expand their power into Europe were bound to be ultimately self-destructive, because trying to rule over an empire of peoples is not going to go well. And some of that has to do with the problems of nationalism that I talked about before. So the Chinese or the Russians, in attempting to kind of run places, if they were dumb enough, attempting to kind of run places that the United States has sort of attempted to run by having a troop presence, would have all the same troubles, if not worse, because they have less experience doing it than we do. That's the main point there. I think, you know, there you can also, I think, have a longer conversation about what it would mean for, like, China to take over for the United States in the Middle East, right? And that's more complicated, because I don't think many people think that China would just kind of try to emulate the basing structure the United States has in the Middle East. And if you read articles, like there was an article in the Financial Times today about Xi going to the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, if you read articles about it, it's, it, you know, the Financial Times is attempting to be specific about what exactly people are worried about, but it's kind of a melange of things about oil prices and influence and market access and weapon sales that I think don't really add up to much. So really sometimes it's not even clear what people mean when they say there's going to be a vacuum left behind.
Let's talk about choke points, the Strait of Hormuz, the Strait of Malacca, the Suez Canal, etc. Why are these considered special and how do you figure them in your argument?
So the argument about territory is in the paper is that there's a few different reasons you might care about territory, whether or not it's gifted to someone by a vacuum or if they just conquer it. And one is that it has this cumulative value, potential power gain capability that we talked about already. Another one is that they could use that territory to shut off trade. So that choke points to me fit into that, that if there's a vacuum or another state like China gains control of parts of the Middle East, they could potentially shut off access to trade through a choke point, so Straits of Malacca or something like that. And there's a few things to say about that. The first is that that's not a made-up concern. And in the United States now, through our what we call command of the commons, meaning that we dominate the international seas with our Navy, or at least have the potential to dominate it because we could stop other people from accessing it. We are the threat to choke points more than anyone else. And, we talk a lot in U.S. national security documents and so forth and speeches about how we're standing up for global trade. And one of the ironies of that, aside from all the sanctions we lay out that disrupt trade, is that our Navy kind of exists as a threat to trade. You know, it's there in theory to keep trade lanes open in the event of a war for U.S. and U.S. allied trade, but it's also there to shut down potentially trade to people we don't like or go to war with. And certainly the Chinese have to worry to some degree about being cut off from seaborne supplies, which they're very dependent on economically. And arguably, that's one of the reasons for the Belt and Road Initiative, the series of investments where they're worried about getting cut off in the event of greater conflict with the United States and looking for alternatives. But, there's an old argument about straits that says, therefore, we need the ability to clear them or keep them open. And I think that's not totally wrong. And that's one of the things the United States Navy should be able to do. It doesn't mean we need to patrol constantly in peacetime, but we should have the capability to keep sea lanes open. But in a lot of cases, you can go around straits. And Eugene Galtz talks about this in various publications, but the trade routes that we're dependent on economically are sort of less brittle and more versatile than we're often told, because you can buy supplies from another place. Or like I already said, the shipments can pay, the price will go up a little, but you could go a different way through, oceans are vast. And so the choke point argument that, Straits of Malacca or the Suez Canal, the global economy depends on them and therefore we're terrifically vulnerable to military disruptions of them is overstated. And, globalization of trade, creating options and so forth makes choke points less important and is a source of security for us in that sense.
I want to go back for a second to this question of nationalism. You talked about how that would be a problem, for example, for China if it tried to obtain and conquer Taiwan. There would be lots of Taiwanese resistance to make it very costly for China. But ironically, it seems to me the only reason China might try to conquer Taiwan is for nationalism, right? If it were just doing a cost-benefit analysis, it might decide that's not the something we want to do, but its own nationalism about where its sovereignty is and is not might drive them to do something really extreme. And then, of course, you have Putin, who made extreme decisions to go into Ukraine. It seems like some leaders are not listening to your point about conquest not paying.
Yes. I'm not making the argument that war between countries is extinct. Just that I am making the argument, which I'm taking from others, including John Mueller, that the declining benefits from a security or economic standpoint of conquest undercut reasons for war. So I would expect there'd be less interstate war. And I think this is a reason why we've had fewer interstate wars, because of the declining benefits. Not that everyone, in a sense, got the memo. So you can still have conquest, and you can still have security dilemmas because states are worried about conquest, and international security is still anarchic, and the possibility of war still looms. But it has gotten more peaceful, and I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine, as Mueller, I think, has written about, is in some ways the exception that proves the rule. I think, you know, the jury's still out on how it will ultimately go for Russia. But thus far, it certainly seems like it's not going to be an example that other states want to emulate, given the costs that have been imposed on them, both by the Ukrainians with their resistance and the sanctions that the West has put on Russia, and the kind of long-term damage that they're likely to face. It's they're paying a lot for their nationalistic desire to grab part or all of Ukraine. And the I think, as you referred to or referenced with in Taiwan, you know, one of the things about aggressive nationalism is it provokes aggressive nationalism, or at least it provokes nationalism, whether or not it's aggressive. So, by invading Ukraine, Russia gave steroids to Ukrainian nationalism. And, you know, countries tend to define themselves in opposition to something. We are X because we're not Y, or even, you know, that's in-group, out-group theory. So just groups of people in general. And, Ukrainian nationalism has been present since before there was a Ukrainian state, but it was given a shot in the arm by being invaded by their neighbor. And I think the idea of Ukrainian state will be stronger, if not forever, for a long time as a result of this invasion. So that just goes to the point that conquest is difficult and not doesn't necessarily pay. So I don't know what Taiwan would do if China invaded them. I don't know that their resistance would go well or how hard they would fight. But it certainly seems a real possibility that the Chinese would encounter a lot of resistance. In fact, the fact that they tried to conquer Taiwan would boost Taiwanese nationalism and make it more militarized and angry.
Some people might hear your argument and respond by saying, you know, they don't expect China or Russia to move in militarily, and all this talk about conquest is not going to happen. But, you know, if we were to withdraw from this or that region, they could slyly use diplomacy or tradecraft to gain influence or some advantage. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I've been reading articles like that for, I think, maybe 15 years about the Chinese are up to something sly in Africa or Latin America, but usually Africa. And I'm thinking of something I read by Tom Ricks, and I think I wrote a blog post about it in maybe 2008 or 9, that they're up to something sly in Africa, and we don't know exactly what it is, but sooner or later we're going to find out, and it's going to be bad. And a similar logic kind of exists around the Belt and Road Initiative, which is, you know, China taking a lot of, you know, it's had this tremendous economic growth, and they're taking a bunch of the money they've gained in reserves, in investing it in infrastructure loans to countries. And yeah, there are questions about the terms of the loans and debt traps and stuff. But, you know, fundamentally what they're doing is giving aid-related loans to countries in their area. And the position of the United States and the Biden administration is basically that we need to copy that, or we need to have our own boosted infrastructure investment in the developing world to counter the Belt and Road Initiative. And the it's funny because, you know, we already have that in a sense. It's called USAID. And we also are, you know, the leading donor, I think, to the World Bank, which does similar things. So, you know, it's not like we're not doing any of that. But, you know, there's this idea that we need to do exactly what China's doing or do something new because they're doing it. And it's just this murky logic that we have to kind of mirror image what we think the Chinese are up to. But so the bottom line that comes out of this paper and my thinking about this is there's not anything from a security standpoint that we need to worry about in Africa. If the Chinese want to invest in mines, and really it's Chinese companies, right? Not usually, I don't know what exactly their relationship is to the state, but I don't think these are like decisions being made by Xi all the time. I think it's, you know, a bunch of different decisions by Chinese merchants and different companies. They're investing in mines and, you know, energy related ventures in Africa and other parts of the world. And if you think that's a problem economically, okay, but that doesn't mean the United States military or the United States national security entities need to do something about it. It's an investment problem. You know, we should be chasing after the same investments, I guess. But, you know, so Chinese investments in Africa, there's a lot to say about them. You could argue about how good they are for people in the places they're investing, if the sort of, you know, abusive labor practices are a problem, as opposed to just the fact that they're investing, which is good, presumably, from almost everyone's standpoint. You could argue about that. But my point is just there's no security thing that we need to be worried about. So calm down.
What does your argument suggest about what overall U.S. military posture should be? Would the U.S. lose anything of value or undermine its security by retrenching and, quote, you know, leaving vacuums, so to speak, in Europe, the Middle East, Africa, or whatever region?
Yeah. I mean, so I think as our conversation has revealed, you know, this paper about vacuums, it's explicitly about vacuums, but in talking about vacuums, it's really about just what is territory overseas matter to us and when does it matter to us? So it's, I don't know, maybe I'm burying the lead, but it's sort of, you know, like a sneaky way of making a broader point. And and my bottom line is it matters way less than we think. And so it's of course, one implication is that we need, we could do with fewer overseas bases. But I think, you know, the implications are even bigger than that. And I'm not the only one who says this, but, you know, that we don't need to worry about, or if we don't need to worry about our enemies controlling all this territory around the world, we could have a fundamentally different foreign policy, certainly more restrained one, more peaceful and quiet, and you know, where you're less likely to find U.S. military forces in your neighborhood if you're in the Middle East or other parts of the world, particularly the developing world. And that doesn't mean that we don't have a foreign policy or that we're isolationists or something like that. It just means that the security reasons for having an expansion area or a big globe-trotting foreign policy are overstated. And so, you know, you might still care about the places where the United States has forces, and you might still want various things from those countries, but that you don't need to worry so much about, you know, somebody else showing up there and using the local resources to come get us.
Benjamin Friedman, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, John. It was a good conversation. I hope it was cogent.